is all about the head of the beer, right?
Yeah.
Like, the bigger the head, the better the beer.
I always prefer a mop head.
Right. I think we've established no James Bond impressions for me because I was doing American for some reason.
You could have just made the quip. I think that would have been good enough. The quip spoke for itself.
Okay, so from here on out in the podcast, if either of us do a James Bond quip, just imagine that we're doing it in a James Bondy voice.
With Roger Moore's wry eyebrow raise and smile.
Okay. So this has turned into one of those openings to podcasts that we both hate.
Cut it down.
The rambling, or I can cut
it down with the scissors.
Yeah.
Scissors of doom.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Radio Show. This month, yet again, we are doing a pop culture taste test. With me is Ben from Manners.
Yeah.
Hello.
Still from Manners.
Yeah, still with a music career despite our NME special. Now, last time we did the NME special, we drank a bit too much red wine as we were doing it, and I had to cut out some fairly libelous stuff. This time, we've just doubled down on that and made this completely about booze. So, Ben, why don't you explain what we are going to be doing today?
What we're going to be doing today is sampling a few of the tipples that Bond likes to enjoy on and off the clock.
Yes, because as we all know, James Bond is a massive raving alcoholic.
He is.
A functioning alcoholic, fortunately, is able to both save the world and the Foreign Office interests of Britain.
True.
Whilst also largely being smashed.
Mm.
So, yes.
Yes, and depending on how serious the tone of the Bond film is, depends on how seriously they take the subject of his alcoholism.
Yeah, well, and I think in the early 60s, it was perfectly fine for a man to be...
I mean, I've watched Mad Men, I assume that everything is true. That happens in that show.
Exactly. And then we get into, in the modern ones, he still drinks, but we're meant to be sad about that.
People mention it.
And I think...
It comes up.
So, talking about the modern ones, this is where we're going to start. We're going to start with the most refreshing one, because we've both done a hard day's toil in the media minds today. And we both need a refreshing drink. So this is exactly the same drink that you, as a secret agent, would have if you have, for example, faked your own death.
Sure.
And are living in random bars. And where are you meant to be?
I don't, like, Cuba. I don't. Maybe it's Cuba. Always Cuba, isn't it?
Yeah, doing scorpion shots and
literally
bedding lovely ladies.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, Heineken.
Yeah. The drink of choice. When fending away the CGI scorpions, one turns instantly to Heineken.
Of course you do. Does this seem like a drink
I quite like Heineken. I mean... You can't talk about Bond and not talk about product placement.
Yeah.
Because the films pretty much these days, especially when MGM went bankrupt, they were solely funded by people coming along and saving the day with advertising. I don't particularly have a problem with this current, like, new iteration of Bond drinking whatever the Heckens he can get his hands on.
Yeah.
So him drinking Heineken is absolutely fine, because if that's what's there, that's what's there. It doesn't particularly bother me too much, but I know a lot of people are up in arms about it.
I mean, the context was fine, because he's in a dingy little hut in the middle of nowhere. He's not going to be drinking, you know, the finest Glenmorangie.
No.
Although Bond, certainly more so in the books, is, of which I've read one.
the books. Book, singular in your case.
The book. And I've overheard people that have read the book say this. But certainly there's this whole food and drink stuff, which is a whole part of the aspirational aspects of the character of this is what a man looks like, this is what a man does and thinks and knows.
Sure.
And a man knows about food and he knows about drink.
Yeah.
And he knows about food to have bacon eggs in the morning to line your stomach with the minimum possible to get you through an entire day of drinking. And in terms of drink, he can tell the difference by taste between a grain vodka and another kind of vodka.
They try and, like, out-drinks knowledge each other. Like, I know him and Em in a few of the scenes and certainly in some of the earlier films, a sort of, you know, being quite cocky when he's like going, oh, well, this is a bonjour de, you know, whatever, I don't really know.
A bonjour de je m'appelle.
Exactly. And just looks disgusted. It's quite fun.
Yeah, and that's a subtle way of letting the audience know that we know
he's
that
well
Bond may not be in charge,
but
he's the best in the room, you know?
In any given situation.
Yeah.
That seemed to be, especially in the Roger Moore years, it didn't really matter what he was good at, as long as it was like he's the bloody best at whatever it was, what situation it was.
And I didn't particularly mind Heineken, because it made sense in terms of that scene. If he'd have been drinking around his bachelor pad, well, no, he wouldn't.
Mm.
Quite, because, you know, he lives in London, he'd have some kind of ridiculous artisan beer from monks in wherever.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a deliberate nod to that kind of drink snobbery in Fast and the Furious 7. yeah. where Kurt Russell, for some reason, always has a great big... He's an American CIA, kind of American James Bond kind of figure, always has a big dispenser of delicious Belgian Trappist monk ale with him.
What was that about? Was it just a crowbar Corona in there? I don't...
Well, but that's the other thing, is that he goes, oh, you should drink this, and then Vin Diesel goes, I'm more of a Corona man myself. That wasn't too bad. But that's kind of the opposite, is him saying, I'm an everyman.
Yeah.
You know, I drink really slightly crap beer that you resent having to pay £5 for in an overpriced London nightclub. But that's the deliberate opposite of what kind of James Bond does, where it's like, I am better than everyone.
Yes.
But then we want him to be better. That's the fantasy of James Bond, is that these kind of functioning alcoholic superheroes are saving us from disaster. To round up Heineken, that's fine.
Yeah, if you were to sum it up in a noise, I think that would be it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yes, well, I'm a fan of the Brosnan years, but much like Doctor Who, you will always have fondness for the James Bond that is at your right age. Okay. I've almost finished my Heineken.
I've absolutely came mine. It's been a long day in the media mine. You've over-allocated.
Okay, so we're moving on now. We're moving on to the classic. The one drink which is most associated with James Bond.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. Yeah. Now, this is kind of like a catchphrase. It kind of denotes the fact that James Bond is an expert. Mm. He has to say to an experienced barman, look, you fucker, you're going to do it like this.
Yeah.
Because I'm James Bond.
But isn't it better to have it not shaken?
Well, this is it. And a nice little marker of the pop culture kind of imprint of this is that is explicitly referenced in The West Wing when Charlie is really chuffed about his tax return that he's going to get. He's going to get loads of money back. He's going to buy the complete James Bond set.
Would you leave enough left over to buy a great DVD I found on eBay?
Yeoman of the Guard?
Oh, how well you know me, Mr. President. On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Can I tell you what's messed up about James Bond?
Nothing.
Shaken, not stirred will get you cold water with a dash of gin and dry vermouth. The reason you stir it with a special spoon is so not to chip the ice. James is ordering a weak martini and being snooty about it.
Well, I'll reflect on that while watching my digital enhanced picture with theater quality sound.
I've put vermouth and vodka and some ice into a shaker. I mean, it's funny because it's whether that's a meta commentary on James Bond himself, like commentary on that ridiculous masculinity of always having to be right about everything. But I suspect that Ian Fleming didn't have that many levels.
That's satisfying. What a satisfying sound.
We've been waiting a bit too long. The ice is there. Melted a bit. Anyway, so here we go. Vodka martini, shaken.
Sure. Yeah.
Not stirred.
I've never had one of these.
Really? Oh, no. So this is new to you. This and you also like have no way of telling whether I've made it right or not, which is excellent.
Yeah. It's going to work out well for you, I think.
So, ordinarily...
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure what his official recipe is. He never specifies whether he has it with an olive. I think you would normally have vodka martini with an olive.
Mm.
We're going to go for lemon on the basis that's what's in my house.
And also, I can't stand olives.
Yeah. So you definitely wouldn't want a dirty martini. Do you know what that is?
No, what's a dirty martini?
Dirty martini, don't worry. It isn't an awful sexual thing. Maybe it is. But dirty martini is where you put some of the olive juice in the mix.
Oh.
So you... Oh. So it's probably invented.
A
little bit more of that.
Yes,
it was probably invented by accident.
Yeah.
Much like penicillin.
Mm.
And it was great a discovery to the benefit of mankind. This is great. So we're going to have this on record, on permanent media record.
Cheers.
Ben's first martini.
Okay. That's pure alcohol.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, it's two shots of vodka.
Yeah.
Mixed with one shot of like vermouth, which is like what's wine.
Okay.
Like 14% alcohol. So you've watered down two shots of alcohol with more alcohol. We've not put cranberry in there. We've not put Coke.
That's great. Ooh. So he gets massively tanked up on these and then performs high-risk ventures with
Silent Gun.
Yeah. Is that the only way you can do it, do you think?
where you can get up. Again, maybe it's a meta commentary on James Bond.
Yeah.
Probably not. That he can only function
if
he's massively tanked.
Yeah.
The martini is certainly a thing that became legendary within the, within the film. because it's like a thing you can do, a thing you can do in every film. It's a thing you wait for. He doesn't have that many of them in the books, apparently. I haven't read one. He doesn't do it that often in the books. He drinks a wide variety of drinks. And in the same way with the car, he doesn't always drive an Aston Martin.
Yeah.
He drives, in fact, more often really associated with a Bentley, but he just drives whatever Ian Fleming likes the idea of being driven, basically. Yeah.
When we were talking about this before we got together to make these cocktails, and we were sort of establishing what the James Bond tropes are and how they're just very quick shortcuts and shorthands to establish the status quo. Because
it's kind of reassuring.
Yeah, it is reassuring because you kind of go into it knowing what to expect. Obviously, the modern James Bond films are now trying to, you know, play on those expectations. But certainly, you know, in those earlier years, in the 60s, 70s, people expected a certain amount from
when they went into it. Yeah, and things like James Bond, even now they don't reject that. But like, there's an explicit, almost statement of intent with Casino Royale, where it says,
"Vodka martini, shaken or stirred. Do I look like I give a damn?"
So the shorthands, the shortcuts, is kind of what I'm getting at, is that early on, is it... Because it was one of the first kind of series of films to really... I think at that point, what had you had in terms of just kind of keep returning to the cinema? Because like...
Well, Carry On, but only parochially.
Mm.
Certainly America never got the Carry On films.
I mean, no one really expected it to turn into the massive multi-billion franchise that it...
Well, the kind of
films...
Famously,
Paramount passed in it when they were taking it to the studios.
I think the kind of films we have now, certainly not, but I think in the spirit of those kind of matinee kind of serials, the idea that you could return every year.
Yeah.
And I think it was quite ambitious in a way that...
I was going to say, the budget for these versus what was the budget on those kind of like Carry On films, matinee films?
Yeah, well, they were just done on whatever sets were available. Mm. You know, they pounded them out. But I remember Barbara Windsor was talking about... Because Carry On were in the set, were like at Pinewood.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, you know, saying, "Oh, you guys still working on that James Bond film? Yeah, we've done two Carry On films. What are you
doing? Why are you going to make it this one film?"
Amazing.
But I think people needed those shortcuts just to get back into the swing of it.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you bring in a new actor playing the same character, you need that little, you know, that is arguably more important than whatever face he happens to be wearing.
All these concepts are kind of like just unheard of at the time, but now it's just kind of part of course.
Well, ultimately, all of this stuff—the locations, the cars, the alcohol, and the fact that knowing, you know, the fine wines—it's all part of. I mean, we're talking about the '60s, a time when before kind of cheap air travel, we're talking about before people could even get on a cheap package holiday to Spain.
Yeah,
people just didn't travel around the world, and you'd see, you know, imagine seeing Japan and You Only Live Twice. Mm. You know, no one you know would ever have gone to Japan in the late 60s, whenever that was. So all that stuff is selling this life you can't have. So which is why the new films have to have a very different take, because you can't just say, "Oh, isn't it nice to go to Cuba?" And just like, my cousin went there on a cheap holiday.
Everyone get on EasyJet. Everyone get on EasyJet. Everyone's got a smartphone. Kind of, where does James Bond kind of fit into this modern world?
Well, exactly. And the kind of, you see him in the old films, those little cameras, the little click click kind of side sliding cameras.
Yeah.
And you think, there's one of those moments every so often I get future shock looking at my phone. I'm going, how does this exist? And we just take it for granted. But the technology on this, even just with the apps I can download for free off the internet, you know, I mean, imagine James Bond would be a bit frustrated if he had to kind of close down pop-up adverts for Candy Crush before taking pictures of the blueprints. But still, like, this is a spy phone. This is a spy phone. Got a tiny silent camera in it.
Yeah.
Can record HD pictures.
Yeah.
You know, this is ridiculous. And so all those kind of spy things kind of have to be different, which is why James Bond these days has to be super pumped.
Yeah.
It has to be, you know, more like a superhero, really. Yes. So what was your relationship to Bond growing up as a child? When did you discover him?
It's kind of boring because it's the same as everyone else's. It's kind of like those weekend afternoon kind of, you know, ITV
what any, you know, Christmas bank holiday,
yeah, or just,
Easter,
just kind of being on. Like, I can't sort of talk about that time without starting to sound like Alan Partridge. But yeah, so growing up, it was basically Roger Moore, the films being on television, and then Roger Moore became sort of my Bond. That was like the go-to Bond. But then
I did prefer him when I was a kid, because I was a kid with slightly campy,
well,
jokey.
That's the thing. It's kind of like my taste in Bond changes as I get older, because the films that I held up so high when I was growing up, now, you know, they're not very good. But yeah, but to say, like, even bad Bond is good Bond, as far as I'm concerned. But
well, it's hard. I'm never going to be completely objective when it comes to Bond.
Yeah,
just
no,
because
totally.
It's just part of me.
Yeah,
now. It's been, you know, Bond as a cult leader. I've drunk the Kool Aid, and I love all, even the really awful ones. There's no Bond film I can't accidentally watch for an hour. Let's move on to the Vespa. This is the cocktail that Bond makes off the top of his head, because he's such a fucking genius.
Yeah.
Can I
just say, I love the scene. First of all, I love Casino Royale. It's one of the best James Bond films by far. And I love the scene where he comes up with his drink just off the top of his head. And I love how frustrated the chief gets.
Send the barman over, please. Dry martini.
Oui, monsieur.
Wait. 3 measures of Gordon's, 1 of vodka, 1/2 measure of quinoa lily. Shake it over rice and then add a thin slice of lemon peel.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'll have one of those. So will I.
Certainly. My friend, bring me one as well. Keep the fruit. That's it?
He knows he's pissing him off, so he's entertaining. He keeps doing this, and it's absolutely, yeah, it's just great. Plus, like, in terms of just, like, making the game of, unfortunately, it becomes poker in the Casino Royale.
Well, because
I don't know. Like,
poker's easier to explain to people visually.
Mm.
Casino Royale being the one book that I've read, Baccarat makes more sense in terms of the way that it escalates rapidly.
Sure.
Is that, basically, and also the way that his character is able to buy an advantage. So if you buy the banker, you get to be banker.
Mm.
Which gives you a statistical advantage over the other players.
Sure.
So the other players are hoping to break the bank. For every round, you kind of basically ante up. And if nobody ante ups, it reverts back to its first amount of money. So every round, it kind of doubles. The pot that you could potentially win, the pot that everyone has to put in, doubles.
Sure.
So you can go within 3 hands from a modest amount of money to record-breaking amounts of money. And that's basically what happens.
Rackets up the tension.
Like. Yeah, and so at the point where James Bond has used up all his money and Leiter bails him out, and then Bond getting to do the same again, win it back within a couple of hands. So within a couple of hands, win back his money and then break the chiffre. It's more exciting in the book because in the book it's able to carefully explain the rules to you in a way that if you were kind of just going for a wee.
Yeah.
During the important bits.
Because I was actually going to credit the film, because like that's what it kind of does. It makes me kind of care about poker visually. Not that I don't enjoy poker, it's just like it makes it visually exciting, and also it does a really good job of kind of like really ratcheting up that tension and making everything, especially the first time when he loses, because you kind of expect him to kind of just like pull the upper hand in like at the last minute.
Well, okay, so the recipe for a Vespa is 60 millilitres gin, 20 millilitres vodka, and 10 millilitres... In the book, it's quinoa lily, which doesn't exist anymore. It's basically a French aperitif wine. See, I've done at least 5 minutes of Googling on this beforehand. and then not understanding what that is, because I'm not James Bond, it's basically like a dry... It basically said a dry wine.
Right.
My research was a bit vague. So I've got a Pinot Grigio because I couldn't be bothered tracking down one of the three, the Cochi Americano or the Lillet Blanc. So it says 10 millilitres, which doesn't seem like it's kind of worth doing. So this is... Where's the
That's
thing?
Not going to be as sweet as... Is it just a standard?
Well, it said dry in the thing.
Okay.
I'm just going to stick a dose in. it's fine.
Happy days.
He's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
It's, right. So what we are creating is something which is within the ballpark of the Vespa, based on 10 minutes of...
thorough research.
10 minutes of Googling and about 15 minutes standing in Tesco looking bewildered. So, my research has suggested that mixologists turn their nose up at the Vespa, which is why it hasn't become a regular on the circuit, on the basis that it's basically, even more than the last one, it's still just a fuckload of booze. it's gin plus vodka plus wine. Plus we're going to put a bit of lemon in there as well, put a bit more in to top us up. But the theory is that essentially it makes sense in terms of story because he's about to go and do, he's steadying his nerves.
Yeah.
And I can't remember this is before or after someone attempts to shoot him in the spine. Which is quite a good bit in the book. A bit where someone tries to shoot me in the spine.
Why the spine?
Well, basically a guy, I'm going to give this a squeeze as well. I'm going to put a little extra lemon in to try and make this a little less awful. because basically a guy sneaks up behind him with a walking stick and kind of puts in his... And it basically tells him it's got like a silenced... It's a one-shot silenced kind of pistol.
Yeah.
And then he'll kind of... He's got it in like the small of his... spine, and they'll fire it, and then James Bond will slump over, and no one will know what's going on. By the time anyone realises he's been assassinated, this guy will be away. And James Bond basically theatrically falls off his chair and manages to not get shot in the spine. Spoiler, James Bond doesn't get shot in the spine. So here we go, the Vespa, which is named, so James Bond makes it up off the top of his head, tries to think what to call it, and then later on, having basically discovered that rather than resenting Vespa, which he did at the beginning of the book and film, he now loves her. To love.
Holy moly.
I mean, I could do that. that works for me. But then I don't have to get the... public transport home. I can just fall into bed when this takes effect.
Pass out on the bed or take on assailants.
It's quite tangy.
I can't taste anymore.
That's good. We've still got scotch and sodas to go. So does this make you think of anything, James Bond? I mean, you can see why this hasn't become...
Runaway hit.
I mean, even with sweet wine in it, it's like... I can't imagine how this would have been. I mean, Smirnoff grain vodka. I'm going to prepare a scotch and soda because I can't imagine we're going to get through these. And also, I feel like we're coming to the end.
I'm going to finish this. I'm going to finish my Vespa, definitely.
Well, you can also have a scotch and soda.
Amazing. Do you know what goes well with pure alcohol?
More alcohol.
More alcohol with a little dash of soda.
The reason why we keep referencing scotch and soda is that actually, across the James Bond books, scotch and soda is what he has more often. But the problem with scotch and soda... It sounds quite mundane. So it doesn't matter that James Bond is probably having some ridiculous, you know, 22-year-old scotch from some obscure provider, like one man with a still in the Highlands of Scotland who only makes 4 litres of it a year, and one of those litres goes to James Bond. It doesn't matter, because if you just say scotch and soda, that sounds like something your dad's drinking. You know, your dad's got some shit scotch, some teachers. He's drinking it in front of Coronation Street. So it's not exotic. That's the whole point of the films, is they're exotic. So, although in the Brosnan years, he's occasionally have himself a cheeky little scotch, you know, some single malt, because that's more in line with modern drinking sensibilities. But in the books, scotch and soda. So I have some scotch. It is a single malt, but just your standard Glenmorangie kind of situation. I can get some ice.
Can I have some ice? Is that alright? Is that effort? Sorry.
I'm just wondering whether, James Bond would approve. So we can debate whether James Bond might have had ice in his scotch and soda. But we can be fairly certain that ice wasn't made into the shape of false teeth as this ice is.
That's great.
Yeah. Incredibly authentic. Really hard to get out of fucking malt, though. So,
good stuff.
But you know, in the films, you know, he drinks sort of occasionally and purposefully, whereas in the books, he's constantly tanking it, which is why scotch and soda is a good option, because it's a lot of booze, but it's watered down, so his instincts stay sharp. Having had his, you know, eggs and bacon in the morning, and maybe some caviar, maybe a bit of salmon on a blini, that's not too communist. Probably on toast, actually, thinking about it. There you go, scotch and soda. So I guess it makes it into kind of a drink rather than just a shot that you would pound your way through.
Yeah, sure.
It's still got...
These fakes are great.
That's
so awesome.
It's just kind of dancing in the top of it.
Oh my god, okay, cool.
Okay, so... to Her Majesty.
Yeah. And her Secret Service.
I mean, that's okay.
That's weird.
I'm a bit more ice though. It used to be cooler. I guess it's weird, because I like scotch. I like whiskey. But I kind of associate it as a strong taste. So you kind of know what you're getting. It's going to be like a big, kind of strong oof to you. I sound like I'm a master chef now. But you put a little soda in it, and it's like you've made a whiskey-flavoured soft drink.
Yeah.
It's kind of like... Like a mate who was obsessed with what was it? Some 2020 or something. Some like shandy based lemonade drink, which had the tiniest amount of alcohol in it, and he was obsessed with it because he was like, "Look at me, I've just bought some booze," and it would be like, "Have you?" Because it's 0.003%. And this is what this kind of tastes like to me. How does it taste like to you, Ben?
Yeah, like watered down scotch with a little bit.
I guess it's what it is.
Fizz in it, and two pairs of iced fake wool dentures.
Yeah. So I guess, but then as I was saying, you know, if you're going to tank several of these during the day, you want them to be a bit watered down, and then kill many men.
Kill many men,
and then a woman.
Potentially, if they're deadly, if you can see them come at you in the reflection of the eyes of the woman.
There's definitely a case for doing it. It'd be hell for me to edit. I'm just doing one of these over the course of about 12 hours. And then at the end, we'll just be, oh God, what with something?
Bond.
He's the man for the job. Well, the Vesper is not going down well.
Is the Vesper not going well? I'm enjoying the Vesper more than this soda thing, because it just kind of feels to me like
I think I'm going from one to the other. That's my problem, is that the best really, sweeter.
I'm not really a soda drinker, and like this tastes to me like I'm getting a bit West Country now. it sounds late. I've got to stop saying
like.
You know when you get like Pepsi or whatever from a carbonated drink, and it like you don't get the syrup, you just get the soda. So it tastes to me like a watered down Pepsi.
Like the syrup is at the end of its bag.
Exactly.
Or gland bag. Or whatever it is have at the bar.
The glands, we call them glands.
Okay, it's getting late, so let's just say any thoughts to follow? So of all these James Bond drinks,
yeah.
Which one would you actually drink again?
All of them.
Now?
Together. Let's go.
In one.
Let's do it. Make me a dirty pint of all of them.
God.
No, I really didn't like the soda.
Martini?
It's just nothing.
It just felt like a less good version of scotch.
It's just pure. All of it was pure alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, and I like alcohol, so it was. You know,
I think you do.
It's
for me the martini.
Yeah,
the martini was nice. It was nicely balanced. That's the thing that the Vesper is being slagged off for. It's actually not balanced very well. But it actually makes sense in the context of the book, because he's just having a big slab of booze because he's about to go and bet like £20,000 of MI6 money, and in those days that's
a lot of money. So what are your favourite? Am I allowed to say favourite Bond films?
I refuse to be held to this, but
because it changes for me. This is exactly why I was trying to like get along.
Do you know what? I'm discounting Dalton and Lazenby.
Why are you discounting them?
Well, because I'm going to do a Bond. I'm going to do a favourite film from each Bond.
Because everyone.
Because Lazenby. Well, there's only one.
Yeah.
And Dalton.
But a lot of people like hold On a Majesty's Secret Service in high regard.
Yeah, but in
which
terms
I'm still
of
not on board with.
In terms of doing a best Bond film for every actor, which
sure.
is what I was going to do.
Okay.
There's kind of no Sorry. Point because no. Lazenby only has one.
Sure.
And much like most Bond films, his Lazenby's Bond film is massively uneven. Its high points are very high, though. But you can't help but watch it and go, oh, but if this could have been Connery, or even more, it's
anyone else but Lazenby.
I mean, you've got Diana Rigg. Diana Rigg's so good, and it just needs to either get rid of the middle bit in Blofeld's Fuck Palace, or somehow involve Diana Rigg in Blofeld's Fuck Palace,
yeah.
Because he has the early on kind of romance with her. Then he goes to the Fuck Palace, and then he tries to escape the Fuck Palace, and then she drives him to safety, and then the rest of the film happens. So it's like two different films, really.
Yeah.
And the best thing in that film is Diana Rigg by a country mile. Okay, so favorite Connery, I'm gonna say Goldfinger, on the basis that it set the tone, but I will always have, despite the quite bad racism of it, I will always have a soft spot for you and Live Twice.
Do you know what? That's like, I rewatched that one, and out of all the Connery ones, that was the one that really changed. Kind of rewatching it, yes.
All the weird stuff where he becomes Chinese. Japanese.
There's so much about it, and it might just be a testament just because it is like a slice of you know 60s Tokyo.
Even when I was a kid in the 80s. Like having ninjas rappel down the inside of a volcano to fight other ninjas blew my head open.
And I just thought that was a set piece as well that wouldn't help, wouldn't like hold up. But it's just like the fact that it was actually this giant set and they actually did it.
Loads of people. I mean, it's myth that those ninjas are armed with revolvers and grenades. Which seemed a bit anachronistic, because where are the katanas throwing stars, and why can't they melt into the shadows? But actually, it's probably a bit more realistic in terms of ninjas, because they were just, you know, guys. So Goldeneye for the Connerys, for the Moors, a bit difficult. I mean, Spy Love Me was my favourite for a long time.
Yeah.
Spy Love Me, I'm just going to say that. for Brosnan, Goldeneye.
Yeah.
And for Craig, I'm split. I think Casino Royale is better than Skyfall, but it's actually quite a close run thing.
Yeah, it is.
So how do you feel about
that? You've not said anything that's kind of really different from mine, except I would go with having recently rewatched most of the Moore ones. It's
in the crispest of definitions.
In the crispest of definitions. It's got to be. It's got to be Live and Let Die for more. And then it's got to be...
Of the Wings theme tune?
It's going to be...
I mean, Live and Let Die... there's so much...
I mean, we can have a separate conversation. I'm obsessed with James Bond theme tunes. I absolutely love License to Kill. It's just literally one of the best.
Good License to Kill. I
love that theme tune. It's amazing. And it's kind of like... Yeah,
worst
film.
Bond film theme tune.
Worst Bond film at
yeah.
All Time High. I hate All Time High. All Time High and maybe... Diamonds Are Forever is not particularly...
Yeah, but the same... Diamonds Are Forever!
Yeah, kind of makes sense. All Time High is just abysmal. I hate that song. It's so bad. And... But then Die Another Day, Madonna... Which
another
is the
day.
Worst thing.
Another
no, okay, so it's Die Another Day. Definitely,
it's the worst.
By far. Because it's not really a theme tune, it's just a noise that a sort of drill makes sometimes. It's not really...
Like when a drill
hits
an old nail in a wall.
Yeah. It's just a series of...
that you should have just had as the theme tune.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have heard that.
Be like a non-inch nail song.
What's going on? I would have paid attention. That was great. What's going on?
They should have got well.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind how Trent Reznor has become, thanks to David Fincher, an incredibly respectable theme tune composer.
Yeah.
Maybe we should go Trent Reznor for the next one.
I'd be up for that, but I don't think I'm going to do it.
Did you?
It's going to go in a much more grand, especially after how well Adele's Skyfall did.
To be fair, classic.
I mean, it is absolutely great.
Okay, so just to sum up, would you have any of those drinks again?
Oh, right, okay.
Let's bring it back to the original
concept. I quite like the Vespa.
Really?
Yeah.
More than martini?
But I just don't really drink that combination of alcohol in the combination that the alcohol was presented to me.
For me, the martini. And over the course of the weekend, I did have some gin martinis. Gin martini I preferred slightly more.
We didn't even have any gin. Did we have any gin? We didn't.
There was gin in the Vespa.
Okay, good.
And that involved all the gin. Otherwise, I would have made you a gin martini. Okay. But that's not the one that James Bond likes.
Sure.
He would sneer at you. So.
A Roger Moore sneer or a...
The Sean Connery sneer Sean where you Curry where you're sneer. Genuinely worried that he might.
I wouldn't like that. Roger Moore sneer, fine.
The Roger Moore sneer, he would sneer, then laugh and throw an arm around your shoulder and go, it's okay, you're not me.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas the Roger Moore one, the Sean Connery one, he would throw an arm around you and have like a glass in his hand and you'd be a bit worried, you wouldn't be sure whether it was going in his mouth or in your face. So,
yeah.
Whereas Brosnan would just be riding a horse along the beach somewhere. Okay, well that was my attempt at for me, martini was delicious. I mean, Heineken is fine. You'll have a Heineken again. Perfectly delicious beer.
Yeah.
I won't have a Vespa again, having had it.
Is that literally you're never going to have it again? I'm not either.
I'm never going to personally go out of my way to make it again.
Sure. And that's the only time I'll ever have a Vespa is if you personally make it again for me.
Yeah.
Neither of us are ever going to have Vespas ever
A friend
again.
Of mine was saying that he really wanted to make the Vespa. And he was a bit more enthusiastic than I was for tracking down an alternative to Keane Linnet. So if he does that, I would have another one.
Sure.
With the Keane Linnet rather than a Pinot Grigio, which I think might be completely inappropriate.
I don't think
it In which case, I would have one to try. Otherwise, martini. Martini's my first best. Heineken's my second best.
Okay.
I think I would have the Vespa before the scotch and soda. Because I would just have some scotch.
Yeah. Or, I wouldn't have soda.
I mean, adding the soda is just pretending it's an actual drink rather than just scotch. And I guess, again, meta commentary on Bond. He is someone that would have scotch and soda rather than just having scotch. Mm. I mean, and these days, scotch would go, no, you don't have soda. You have a single drop of mineral water to release the flavours. That's the current whiskey snob thinking on. Ben, thanks for coming around and drinking talking James Bond with me.
Thanks for making cocktails.
I think there's only one of those things that we had tonight that can even remotely be called a cocktail. So that was the James Bond taste test edition of the Pop Culture Radio Show. Thanks very much to Ben Mercer for coming and joining us. The Pop Culture Radio Show is on all the usual social media things, Facebook and Twitter and, whatever. Please come and find us because we are lonely and in need of validation of strangers. You can also subscribe on iTunes if you want to hear our voices again. I hope you do. Anyway, till next time, thanks for listening.